polls show the race is too close to call. The ruling Democratic Party has put the United States in a historically unprecedented and potentially explosive situation. Polls show a nation evenly split on if Trump did anything illegal on January 6th and if it is time to move on from the events that day. Trump's approval rating is up 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down. Many Republicans have said that the long-delayed indictments for Trump, a sweetheart plea agreement for Biden's son, and the FBI's admitted collusion with social media companies to censor reporting which could have negatively impacted Biden in 2020 is proof of political bias in the nation's judicial system. Trump's defense is likely to include that he acted on the advice of well-regarded legal counsel, which may make it difficult to show criminal intent, and that he honestly believed the vote was not legal. A new poll shows that 70% of Republicans also believe that Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate. Multiple court cases against Trump, an increasingly likely impeachment trial in Congress for Joe Biden, ongoing corruption allegations against Joe's son Hunter Biden. The 2024 presidential campaign is shaping up to be even more divisive and full of mudslinging than in 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It has been 4 years since India removed the semi-autonomous status of the Indian administered portion of the Muslim-majority region of Jammu and Kashmir. But here, anger still rages. Hundreds of Pakistanis took to the streets across the country to mark this year's 5th August, the fourth anniversary of the New Delhi's decision to abolish the autonomy of the region by including it in the Indian Federation. In 2019, India scrapped the semi-autonomous status of the disputed region, a controversial move that prompted Islamabad to cut its diplomatic ties and halt trade with New Delhi. The protesters demanded the Indian government to end what they call illegal occupation of Kashmir, accusing it of grave human rights violations that are constantly being unearthed.
If the deliberate determination is granted to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, the matter will be decided once for all. And if this matter is decided, the South Asia will be peaceful, there will be no nuclear war, and there will be no conflict.
People also demanded the UN to implement a decades-old resolution that called for a referendum on whether Kashmiris wanted to merge with Pakistan or India.
We want to convey our message that we Kashmiri want our basic and fundamental right that was promised by United Nations and other organizations.
Besides rallies, conferences and seminars were also held in major cities and towns to denounce human rights violations in Jammu and Kashmir.
Whoever they are at the helm of affairs, that they should come forward and they should intervene. They should try to mitigate the human rights violations.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority Himalayan region, is divided between India and Pakistan, and both claim it in full. The Kashmir dispute also led to several wars between the two nuclear-armed Asian rivals since they were separated back in 1947.
Pakistanis keep saying that they will continue to lend moral, diplomatic, and political support to the just cause of Kashmir. They have also called on neighboring India to honor its commitments to the Kashmiri people regarding the right to self-determination. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Leaving Lebanon's economy with an almost total economic meltdown, Riyad Salemi has stepped down as the governor of the central bank. The central bank's newly appointed acting governor, Wasim Mansouri, on Monday called on the government to implement a capital control law, a financial restructuring law, and a 2023 state budget within 6 months.
We were able to convince the government that the subsidies policy needs to stop, and as a result, management improved, and the economy relatively began to recover. However, the government's need for the U.S. dollar continues, since the only way to end the government's reliance on the central bank was to improve public finances. The problem is not monetary and the solution is not with the central bank. The main issue is in the financial policies of the estate, and there needs to be a clear decision to improve general management.
He stressed that the bank would impose restrictions on when to lend money to the government. Salemi was for years credited for economic recovery following Lebanon's civil war, yet now he is being investigated by at least seven countries, including Lebanon, for embezzlement and illicit enrichment. He denies the accusations. A former advisor to three central bank governors in Lebanon tells Press TV that Salemi was merely following the U.S. policies.
He was implementing the U.S. policies, and U.S. policies since the end of World War II stipulated that the countries of the Third World are prohibited from development. They only allowed Korea and Taiwan to prosper since they want to confront China and Russia, but they also supported Israel in this region and even prevented Egypt from becoming an industrial nation.
The problem, he believes, is a problem of mismanagement as well as in the structure of the policies, which bound the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar.
He pegged the price of the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar, saying that this would stabilize the lira, but this was a catastrophic mistake, which I had warned against. The U.S. dollar itself is not stable, so pegging the lira to the U.S. dollar won't make it stable. We needed to peg our currency to a basket of currencies based on imports to Lebanon. This impacted Lebanon's ability to compete in the global markets.
The current financial crisis began in 2019 when the value of the Lebanese lira plummeted and inflation soared in the Arab country. After 30 years in his post, Lebanon's former central bank governor is seen by many experts as being the main orchestrator of the financial and monetary policies, which led to an abrupt collapse. However, there are also speculations that he couldn't have done it without collaboration from the country's political elite. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Speaking to Press TV, Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
For the first time, America is set to put on trial a former president in one of the most consequential criminal cases in the country's legal history. Ex-President Donald Trump has faced criminal charges for a third time in 4 months.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The indictment pertains to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat to incumbent President Joe Biden. It focuses on his actions in the two-month period between his loss to Biden and the infamous riot in Washington, D.C. During this period, Trump vehemently denied the election results, repeatedly asserting that the votes had been stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
According to the indictment, Trump knowingly propagated false fraud claims and exerted pressure on state and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, to manipulate the election results. When failed, Trump directed his supporters to stop certifying Biden's win. That turned into a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, leading to 5 deaths, a move that is described as an attack on America's democracy.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
Trump vehemently dismisses the case as ridiculous and maintains his innocence, refuting any allegations of wrongdoing. He even goes further to accuse the prosecutors of being politically motivated, claiming they are acting on behalf of Biden to meddle in the forthcoming presidential elections, in which Trump and Biden could face off again. The two are currently tied in polls. The Trump campaign has also asserted that the Tuesday indictment amounts to election interference. Nonetheless, this is not the only obstacle standing in the way of Trump's return to presidency. The Republican politician has already been charged in 2 other cases, mishandling classified files and falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film actress. The charges that have significantly hit the former president's reputation among many Americans.
I hope he goes to prison for a long time. I think he deserves to go to prison for a long, for all the crimes he committed.
Donald Trump is now due to appear in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. He faces 78 criminal counts overall. These charges mean the ex-president will have 3 criminal trials to attend in the next 12 to 18 months, complicating his second run for the White House.
A private workshop in Kabul, where over 50 women are working and being trained, has provided a place for women to learn making different handicrafts. These women are producing stunning artifacts, despite the problems they stumble upon.
We produce traditional clothing such as leather purses and shoes, hats, carpets and traditional dresses. We used to earn a living previously, but now our sales have decreased and most families face economic problems as a result.
Fereshta Hashemi, the woman who launched this place, says more and more women are showing interest in private workshops because restrictions imposed by the Taliban has deprived them from social activities.
Previously, the schools and universities were open to women, but now, as a result of the restrictions on women, girls cannot go to school and female teachers have lost their job, which is why they show interest in learning a profession so they could work in the future and earn a living.
Lida, one of the trainees in this workshop, was a teacher when the Taliban banned women from education and women teachers lost their jobs. She says maybe in the future this profession helps her earn a living.
Previously, I was a teacher and I lost my job. I wanted to learn a profession, so I came here. I am learning leather crafting now and hope to run my workshop someday to earn a living.
When the Taliban took control of the country in 2021, they banned women from education and gradually from most of the jobs in the country. Even most female-dominated professions like women's hairdressing salons were closed a week ago.
Women in Afghanistan are taking refuge in small businesses not only to provide for their families, but also to get relieved from the mental pressure of being restricted from education and the other jobs they used to do. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
In the limelight.
More than 100 top medical journals, researchers have collectively warned about the looming nuclear threat to the world. Researchers say the threat of a nuclear catastrophe is great and growing under the current global political environment. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. More than 100 global medical journals have called for urgent action to eliminate nuclear weapons as the threat of a global nuclear catastrophe was great and growing. An editorial published on Thursday, 3rd of August, in numerous medical journals called on health professionals worldwide to alert citizens and leaders about the major danger to public health posed by nuclear weapons. The editorial, co-authored by the editors of 11 leading medical journals, including the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, the JAMA, and the New England Journal of Medicine, said, "The danger is great and growing. The nuclear-armed states must eliminate their nuclear arsenals before they eliminate us." Chris Zelinsky of the World Association of Medical Editors said, "It was an extraordinary development that the competing journals had joined forces." He said in a statement, "The fact that all of these leading journals have agreed to publish the same editorial underlines the extreme urgency of the current nuclear crisis." Citing previous research, the editorial warned, "Even a limited nuclear war involving only 250 of the 13,000 nuclear weapons in the world could kill 120 million people outright and cause global climate disruption, leading to a nuclear famine, putting 2 billion people at risk." Ira Helfand, the former president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War and a co-author of the editorial, said, "We are facing an extraordinarily dangerous moment where the possibility of nuclear war is very real." Pointing to Dmitry Medvedev's recent comment, where the former Russian president said, "His country will be forced to use a nuclear weapon if Ukraine succeeds in its ongoing counteroffensive to tear off part of the Russian territory," Ira Helfand said, "We don't know if the threats are real or if they're just put forward to scare people, but I think we have to take them very seriously." The Slate, a US-based online magazine, has also covered the same story. While Russia and North Korea are being blamed for nuclear threats, the United States for 2023 allocated $813.3 billion for its defense budget, with a nearly $60 billion increase from previous year. In this huge defense budget, an enormous share of $50.9 billion has been allocated to nuclear weapons, recording a 17% increase over $43.2 billion, which was allocated in 2022. About a third of this outlay is for the Energy Department's nuclear complex, including its weapons laboratory, plutonium pits, and the production and testing of warheads and bombs. Being the first country to use nuclear weapons, the United States dropped the world's first atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on 6 August 1945, destroying the city and killing 140,000 innocent people. It dropped a second atomic bomb just 3 days later on the city of Nagasaki, killing another 17,000 people. The country has reportedly spread its nuclear arsenal in several countries across Europe, including in Italy, Germany, Turkey, Belgium, and the Netherlands. In a bid to replace its nuclear weapons system, the United Kingdom is also set to spend approximately £172 billion from 2019 through to 2070. The 2023 Integrated Review Refresh, a government review that covers foreign policy, defence and international issues, has confirmed that an additional £5 billion will be provided to the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, over the next 2 years to help replenish and bolster vital ammunition stocks and modernise Britain's nuclear enterprise. In the Integrated Review of 2021, the government declared that the United Kingdom will now move towards an overall nuclear weapons stockpile of approximately 260 warheads. With an increase of over 40% from its previous nuclear stockpile. It is important to mention that London has been the largest provider of military support to Kiev in its war against Moscow. Russia's Itatas news agency has also covered the same story. Konstantin Vorontsov, deputy director of the Russian Foreign Ministry's Department for Non-Proliferation of Arms Control, said recently, "The West's military support for Ukraine risks escalation of the conflict, which may bring about a direct confrontation of nuclear nations with disastrous consequences for the world." The Russian diplomat added, "The West is becoming increasingly more determined to pursue the course of an open confrontation with Russia, which has resulted in the crisis around Ukraine." The Russian diplomat emphasized, "Statements about the need to defeat us on the battlefield and strategically pumping the Kiev regime with weapons, including advanced missile systems, providing intelligence and earmarking military and civilian targets that we defend, the direct involvement of Western advisers and mercenaries in hostilities, leading to the deaths of Russian soldiers and Russian officers as well as civilians, all this brings the West extremely close to becoming a party to an armed conflict with our country." Konstantin Vorontsov added, "This is likely to escalate all the way up to direct military clash of nuclear powers with all the ensuing disastrous consequences." Vorontsov stressed, "We consider this policy irresponsible and destructive. It seems that the United States and other NATO countries have come to believe that they can fully control the escalation that they are triggering and manage it without the damage to themselves. But this is an extremely dangerous illusion." China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. A Chinese military spokesperson recently refuted remarks by some U.S. military officials to hype up the so-called Chinese nuclear threat and bullying behavior, saying the United States is the biggest nuclear threat to the international community and the one that undermines the rules-based international order. Wu Qian, spokesman for the Ministry for China's Ministry of National Defense, said, "The U.S. officials ignore the facts and engage in groundless speculation for the purpose of justifying the development of the United States' own nuclear forces, as well as maintaining and strengthening its global hegemony. Wu Qian added, "It is known to all that the United States has the largest nuclear arsenal in the world." He added, "To ensure its absolute security and military superiority, the United States has pulled itself out of several international treaties on arms control and non-proliferation, consistently pushed the deployment of anti-missile systems worldwide, sought to deploy land-based intermediate-range missiles in Europe and Asia-Pacific region, and formed the Cold War-like cliques through multiple ways." Wu Qian, spokesman for China's Ministry of National Defense, warned that such move has increased the risk of nuclear confrontation or even a nuclear war, posing a serious threat to international security. Wu Qian said it is both unfair and unsustainable to try to build one's security on the security of others. He reiterated China's self-defense nuclear strategy and its commitment to a nuclear policy of no first use of nuclear weapons at any time and under any circumstances, and not using or threatening to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states or nuclear weapon-free zones unconditionally. He said the United States is a globally recognized rule-breaker when it comes to the rules-based international order, and it is the least qualified to blame other countries in terms of international law and international rules.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, reiterated years ago that the era of hit-and-run policies by hegemonic forces are over. He said, if you hit Iran, you will be hit back. Now, this statement has been reiterated by Iranian military officials as 3,000 U.S. military personnel have arrived in the Red Sea area. Tensions have been heightened as the U.S. has confiscated Iranian oil and its tankers. Iran, in turn, took a tanker headed for a U.S. oil company in the Persian Gulf and says it will stop more tankers if Washington continues to facilitate pirates and confiscate Iranian oil. Well, where is all of this going? We'll be taking a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Glenn Thiessen, professor of political science, University of Southeastern Norway, out of Oslo. And George Zamudli, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University out of Budapest. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start this off in Oslo. Glenn, why do you think that Washington's goal is right now in sending 3,000 sailors and Marines to the Red Sea? What message is it trying to send?
Would like to have an escalatory dominance over Iran, which means that they should be able to escalate tensions, and then Iran would have to step aside or bow and effectively allow the U.S. to have its ways, as opposed to reaching a common settlement. So Obviously, the relations between Iran and the U.S. has gone from bad to worse. Part of the problem, of course, is this tit-for-tat seizing of tankers. But this is nothing unusual. Your news segment mentioned the role of hegemons. Well, throughout history, the ones dominating the seas have been able to condition the freedom of navigation on abiding or aligning with its policies. So countries who defy the hegemon would have some of its freedom of navigation withdrawn, which is what we've seen when the United States illegally seizes these Iranian tankers as well, which is an act of piracy. So this is obviously a key problem. And of course, we have other tensions where the U.S. would like to pressure Iran on as well. For example, the Iranians are pushing back against the U.S. illegal occupation of Syria, taking its oil and its agriculture. But I would just say that in such a situation, you would ideally have both sides sit down and reach an agreement based on international law and common rules applying for both sides. Unfortunately, instead, we see that we have this hegemonic international rules-based order in which the goal effectively is that the U.S. should be allowed to seize Iranian tankers while at the same time policing Iran from doing exactly the same. So in other words, one set of rules for us and a different set of rules for you. And just going back to my initial point, this is the whole purpose of a hegemonic rule. This is why all hegemonies throughout the past few centuries have always focused on controlling the seas. This is a key aspect.
Well, George, you heard Glenn make a couple of points. Your perspective, because is this what we're seeing? Is it indicative of that transition from the unipolar world to the multipolar world? Because as Glenn was saying, there's one set of rules for everybody else and a different set for the United States. But countries are no longer accepting that. And as I said in my intro, what Iran is saying is that if you hit us, we will hit you back. So is all of this a part of the whole transition, this switch that we're seeing globally?
Well, it's it's a desirable switch, but of course, it's one thing to say we're going to move to a multipolar world from a unipolar world, and another thing to achieve it, because the unipolar world is actually quite powerful, and the United States is still the overwhelming military and economic and financial power in the world, which is why it is absolutely determined to prevent any other power arising to challenge it. So what happened recently was this rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, brokered by China. Well, of course, the United States isn't just going to allow China to move in to the Persian Gulf into the Middle East and become a power broker and displacing the traditional role of the United States. And so the United States has done what I think Glenn said, you know, it's acted like a hegemon, and it does this by fostering conflict. So by moving in, seizing Iranian oil, enforcing some kind of unilateral illegal sanctions, it's provoking Iran into retaliation. And of course, if Iran retaliates, then it provokes conflicts with its neighbors. And obviously, you know, that will mean Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. And by provoking this conflict, then the United States appears as the savior. Here we are, we're saving you from the horrible, terrible Iranians. We're going to provide you with protection. We're going to give you all our Marines to make sure that those terrible Iranians don't seize your tankers. So that's what the Americans are trying to do. They're trying to break this implicit rapprochement between Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states, and go back to the way it was just a couple of years ago, which is the deep conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, with the United States constantly on the brink of going to war with Iran.
Glenn, your take on what George says, do you agree? And if you do agree with his assessment, Do you think that the United States will be successful in creating this conflict between Iran and its neighbors? Or do you think that these Persian Gulf states have seen enough of what Washington really believes in and are able to actually go against the will of the United States? I mean, your assessment of these Persian Gulf states, are they basically saying yes still to whatever Washington says, or do you see a difference in them?
Well, I would agree that this is the role that the U.S. plays, because its power derives to a large extent from being a security provider. So in order to provide security, if this is where your political influence as well as economic loyalties come from, then of course you always have this incentive to instigate conflicts. This has been the case ever since the Second World War. You see it on all sides of the Eurasian continent. If you look at the eastern parts with Japan, for example, it's worth keeping in mind that the U.S. actually threatened Japan against signing a peace agreement with the Soviet Union in 1956. It actually threatened to take Okinawa from the Japanese if they signed peace with the Soviets. And the purpose, of course, keep the conflict alive. Then the Japanese will depend on the Americans and they will have to cede some of their sovereignty. We see the same now in Europe, of course. This is why why we expanded NATO, why we continued to maintain these military blocks and zero-sum security architecture. It creates threats, conflicts with Russia. In Europe, we become dependent on the U.S. for security. Hence, we hand over a lot of our political sovereignty and have to express a lot of economic loyalties. And this is obviously what the U.S. also would like to create in the Gulf states or in the Middle Eastern region. Now, obviously, there's a very interesting article which came out not too long ago from The Intercept, which pointed out that the argument has always been that U.S. military might in the Middle East was the source of peace, but as soon as the U.S. military might start to decline, we saw that states started to come together and seek mutual beneficial peace agreements, which was mentioned now that the Chinese were able to negotiate. So obviously, once there's no conflict, there's no need for the Americans anymore. Suddenly, they need the ability, the access to energy in the region, the willingness to trade in the U.S. dollar, political and military loyalties, all of this then begins to go away. In regards to your final question about whether or not it will be successful, I think what's changed is that the entire distribution of power is very different. The multipolar distribution of power is already here. So I think that what you will see is the Arab states, they don't want to fall under solely the U.S. hegemon, because once they become too dependent on the U.S., then the U.S. will make them cut their ties with the Chinese, for example, or the Russians, you know, what the Americans are now telling the Europeans to do. So I think that for this reason, it's simply in the self-interest of the Arab states or the Persian Gulf states to maintain better relations with Iran and not walk into this trap. But again, it remains to be seen. Conflicts can always be instigated, so I'm a bit hesitant to look into my crystal ball.
Well, I want to get back to this situation that the United States, George, says that, for example, Iran has gone against the sanctions. That's why they can take its oil. Now, of course, there's no international sanctions preventing Iran from selling its oil. Unilateral American sanctions. In the very beginning, Glenn talked about international law. It's as if international law does not exist at all when it comes to the United States. So Iran is saying that if they're going to do it, Tehran is also going to do it also. What we know right now is that in April, 800,000 barrels of Iranian oil worth about $56 million was stolen and taken to Texas. Now, the oil is still in the tanker because Iran has also threatened any American oil company taking this oil that, you know, they will be considered as part of all of this theft. Where do you see this going? I mean, do you think that the United States will continue doing this? And what does it mean as far as with these American oil companies and working hand in hand with the American military?
I think it will continue because I think that, as I was saying earlier, China's sudden emergence as a peacemaker, a diplomatic broker in the Middle East, caught the Americans on the hop, and they didn't like it one bit, which is what explains the sudden escalation of tensions with Iran. So again, the Americans have gone back to the tried and true method, which is escalate conflict with Iran. And that, of course, puts everyone on the spot. Whose side are you on? Are you with the Iran or are you with the United States? And the United States is used to countries making a decision saying, well, we're with the United States. I mean, the United States is much bigger, much stronger, much richer. It makes sense to go with them than to take your chances with Iran or anyone else. So the whole JCPOA, it was never the whole idea was that Biden was going to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That was a non-starter. Biden had no intention of doing that. I think all of those negotiations were really mostly a sham. Biden was just going along with it, I think maybe trying to keep Obama and the various Obama acolytes who were still working for him, keep them happy by pretending to be interested in going back. He had no intention of going back to it. And I think that as we head towards the election, and given at the moment the American and NATO failures in the war in Ukraine, I think Biden will want to rally the country behind a military venture that looks much more doable and much more likely to succeed, namely against Iran, than against Russia, which is a very, very risky proposition. Who knows what might happen there. With Iran, I mean, this is something that the Americans have been doing for a long time, and Biden thinks that he could win some easy points at home by escalating this conflict, this tit-for-tat battle against Iran, particularly as hatred for Iran is very bipartisan. Democrats and Republicans, they're all on board with it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Increasing tensions. Well, Glenn, when we're talking about U.S. increasing tensions, I mean, we can just about look at in so many different parts of the world now, whether we're looking at the South China Sea, whether we're, you know, dealing with the situation with China or North Korea or Iran. It's just so many places. I mean, does Washington not think that it can really overstretch itself? I mean, is it in a position right now that it feels that basically it has no choice if it wants to continue at least trying to be the hegemon of the world? They have to create as much chaos and discord as possible.
Well, this is what it looks like when you have declining hegemons. Keep in mind, when there's a huge concentration of economic and military power in a hegemon, then it has an incentive to create a very liberal international economic system, one which is trusted by the whole world in order to have administrative control over effectively the global economy. So in these instances, we see that reputation is very important to hold and to keep. But we have entered a different era. The global primacy is already over. And whenever you have a declining hegemon, it can no longer afford, if you will, to prioritize upkeeping of its reputation. Instead, it will abuse its administrative control over the international economy, that is, its control over technologies, key industries, transportation corridors, payment systems, the currency which is being used, and use this in order to prevent the rise of rivals and to punish them and, effectively use any means in order to hold on to power. The problem is, well, and this is what we've seen. I mean, the U.S. now is engaged in piracy, taking Iranian tankers. They're stealing gold from countries. They're blowing up pipelines. I mean, it's seizing companies. It's reckless sanctions. It's gone way overboard. And the problem for the hegemon is the more it does this, the more the rest of the world will begin to defy it, because now the trust is gone. They will no longer accept such an aggressive country to have this amount of administrative control over the international economy. And at this point, it becomes more and more necessary to use military force.
Okay.
And this is why we're entering a very dangerous phase now, because the U.S. obviously is now using using its military against Russia indirectly. It's contemplating very openly to go to war against the Chinese, and of course threatening the Iranians as well. So this is not one should always be worried when there's a declining hegemon. It will be much more trigger happy and more willing to take greater risks in order to restore its former position as a hegemon.
Okay. George, I think the question then would be, with all these other countries, I mean, Glenn just set up a scenario, whether we're talking about stealing oil or grain or blowing up pipelines. We see the United States complicit throughout the world in so many unbelievable acts. I guess the main question would be, what is it going to take for these other countries to stand up to the United States? Because obviously these countries know what's happening. We have the United States in Syria and stealing its oil and sending it across the border. We already talked about the Nord Stream pipeline. I mean, there's so many examples. So what does it take for these other states to say enough is enough? I mean, Glenn said that we're getting there, but we have had so many examples of this. Why aren't more countries standing up to the United States?
Well, part of it is fear, and part of it is also that they're getting a free ride. I mean, the example is Europe. I mean, Glenn mentioned the blowing up of the gas pipeline. Now, here was the United States hitting its close ally and partner, Germany, bashing its economy, causing impoverishment of Germany, causing a recession there, you know, hitting it, this export-driven economy. And how does Germany react? Well, it doesn't. And this has really been the case, because ultimately the Europeans feel that they've got a very nice, cushy life with the United States. They don't have to do anything very much. The Americans provide the security umbrella or whatever, and they can just simply continue doing their own thing, and the United States calls the shots. I mean, there is no longer any kind of an independent Europe that there was 30, 40, 50 years ago, when the Europeans were able to stand up to the United States. Europe has now become a complete dependency of the United States. And something like that could yet happen in the Persian Gulf. I mean, for instance, Saudi Arabia has been putting out feelers for some time that they would like a security partnership with the United States. If tensions continue to escalate with Iran, you know, the Saudis are going to keep pestering Washington, say, well, how about, you know, a security partnership? Why don't you provide us with a security guarantee, the kind that you provide to Europe? I'd say that there's a good chance that the United States would do that. And suddenly,
well, George, let me stop you here. I mean, because there's some
NATO in the Persian Gulf.
Right. Sorry to interrupt you, because there are some that said that actually that's what perhaps brought the Saudis more closer to going after rapprochement, because we saw what happened to Aramco and different things that basically the Saudis were not protected in that sense by the United States. And that set a signal that basically, they're going to be on their own, and they're in close vicinity, obviously, with their Persian Gulf neighbors. So it was something that helped the rapprochement in general. Well, Glenn, because we're almost out of time, I want to look at just in general now. The United States is saying, of course, the reason they're saying that they have to be in the Persian Gulf area, and the majority of the world, basically, is to keep security. Now, Iran is saying, Listen, the Persian Gulf countries themselves can keep the Persian Gulf secure. We do not need these forces from outside of the region to help with security. How do you see this? Where do you see this going? Because the U.S., obviously, they've sent more troops to the Red Sea. On the one hand, Iran can't afford to back down. It's its backyard. And the United States doesn't seem like it wants to back down. Where do you see this going?
Well, this is why we have why there's a strong case for why you need regional security architecture. The United States is on the other side of the planet. The most important thing is that the regional actors learn how to live on the same neighborhood. And so I think that again, this has been a lesson across the world. So. It's hard to see where it's headed, but I agree with that sentiment because, you know, the Iranians have security needs, the Saudis have Qatar, like the whole region really needs to find a way of enhancing common security. The problem is a collective security organization has to seek security with its other members, not against them. The problem is that the U.S. is quite averse to accepting any inclusive security a collective security agreement. Instead, they always prefer alliance systems in which there's us versus them, because once you break out down the region into competing blocks, it can take on a leadership role in which it can exert both, which can both draw economic and political power from. So this is the main problem, and I think the region has to come together and find a way of solving disputes peacefully. It doesn't mean that disputes will not be there, but there has to be a way of resolving disputes in a peaceful manner. This is the core essence of a security architecture, and this has to be distinguished from this alliance system, which are now being very aggressively expanded, not just in Europe and Asia, but now seemingly also in the Middle Eastern region.
And George, 30 seconds. Do you see Russia and or China getting involved in this Persian Gulf area, because as these Persian Gulf countries say they want to be united, but of course we have the U.S.'s aggression, how likely would Moscow or Beijing play a role in this? I mean, we have seen the role that they have played in the rapprochement to begin with.
I don't think that they're going to play much of a role now. I think Russia is very preoccupied with the events in Ukraine. Russia is also quite preoccupied with the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which does touch upon Iran as well. But I think this is just one more headache that Russia doesn't need. China, I think, was also quite concerned about Taiwan. But again, you know, again, there's a pattern as to what the United States does. What the United States is doing in Taiwan is exactly the same as what it's doing in the Persian Gulf. It's provoking. It's there. It moves in with its supposed security guarantees, with its arms flows, and it's fostering conflict. It's provoking a conflict, putting other countries into a situation where they have no other choice but to resort to force and thereby risking a major war. And that's what the United States does masterfully.
And on that note, thank you both. We're out of time. I appreciate you being with us. Glenn Dyson, Professor of Political Science, University of Southeastern Norway, out of Oslo. George